You're listening to Upfront. I'm Brian Edwards-Tiecker. For the entirety of our lifetimes, the planet has been getting more urban. We've been making more cities. We've been moving more people into cities. We've been growing urban limits up and out in pretty much every direction. So much so, in fact, that a future of ever-increasing urbanism seems like something inevitable. But for a lot of human history, cities were the exception to how people lived. And those cities did not always last. After studying four ancient cities that no longer exist as such, our next guest identified some pretty familiar themes: ecological shocks combined with a political system that could not respond to them well, which sounds creepily familiar. Annalee Newitz is a longtime science journalist and editor, does a podcast on the politics of speculative fiction called Our Opinions Are Correct. Annalee's latest books were science fiction themselves, but the latest of them is a return to nonfiction and a dive into what archaeology can tell us about our future called Four Lost Cities, a secret history of the urban age. Annalee, welcome to the show.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
I wanted to start with really basic concepts, like What is the threshold that makes a human settlement a city? What are its defining characteristics?
Of course, because this is the realm of science and social science, you know, there's a number of definitions. And so there's sort of one set of definitions that a lot of archaeologists have circled around, which comes from an early 20th century anthropologist named V. Gordon Child, who made a big list of everything that he thought should make a city. And that included things like pretty modern stuff like taxation and money and written language and monumental architecture and high density living. And so a lot of this stuff has created debate because there are very high density settlements that didn't leave any writing behind and that didn't really have a marketplace. And so you get a lot of disagreement when it comes to certain kinds of large settlements that aren't quite there yet when it comes to their fiscal situation, but they are still these very productive settlements of thousands and thousands of people. So I think it's useful in the modern age to kind of take a lot of that stuff with a grain of salt and say, look, a city is any high density settlement where people are living together and depending on each other economically and socially. And the other piece of that that's really important is that a city doesn't end at its borders. The city is both its urban space, its high density space, and the farms that feed it. So a city is, in fact, a combination of city and farm. You can't have a city without agriculture. And so that's one of the things that we forget when we're defining a city is, you know, the city also needs all that food, it needs all that fuel, and that doesn't come from nowhere.
And I guess conversely, kind of one of the defining characteristics is a city supports a class of people who are not consumed full-time with making food.
That's right. One of the hallmarks of a city is specialized labor. And again, this can look very different depending on the city. But yeah, you'd have people who spend all their time doing metalwork or ceramics or spiritual enlightenment. You know, once you have a city, people can be relieved of their duties, you know, tending the flocks and picking potatoes and can just spend all day being a shaman. And that's actually a very important part of city building, is having people who can do things that are not immediately necessary for survival, but that are important for building a culture and building a shared social view of the world.
So the first city that you get into in the book is of a size that we probably wouldn't describe as a city today. I grew up in an incorporated entity in New York with about 25,000 people in it. It calls itself a village. Catalhoyuk maybe peaked at 20,000 people 9,000 years ago. Tell us about it and why you spent so much time on it.
Catalhoyuk is a city in central Turkey. And as you said, it was a going concern about 9,000 years ago during the Neolithic period. And that means that the height of technology there would have been stone tools and ceramics. And ceramics are, in fact, a huge technological innovation. So don't sneeze on ceramics. And this is a city that's incredibly important because it's one of these places that occupies this space between kind of a mega village and kind of a city. It's an emerging city. And the people there left no writing behind. So we don't know what they called themselves. We don't know much about their beliefs. They did leave behind a lot of art and a lot of sculpture. And of course, a city grid that now archaeologists are excavating. And this is a city that lasted for almost 2,000 years. People were living there. So it was very, very successful. But the population was relatively small compared to a city now. Anywhere between 5,000 and 20,000 people were there at any given time. And they were living in these very small, almost apartments or condos that shared walls with their neighbors and that were entered through doors in their roofs. So in order to actually visit someone in this city, you would have climbed up a ladder and walked across people's roofs until you found your friend's door. And people did a lot of work on the roofs, too. So the roof was kind of the street. And people built this way, like I said, for hundreds of years in this place and at other villages in this Levant area. And it's a, such an interesting city because it really represents kind of a path not taken when it comes to urban design and culture. It definitely would have been one of the biggest settlements of its time. You know, people who lived around it in villages would have been living in groups of like 50 or 100. So no one would have thought it was small in that era. At the same time, it didn't have a lot of the characteristics of what we think of as the sort of classic V. Gordon Child city. It didn't have money. It didn't have a marketplace. It didn't have any monumental architecture. So no palaces, no temples, no ziggurats, just a bunch of houses stuck together. And it feels, when you visit and when you see the layout, it feels very democratic in a way that cities today don't. And I think that may be partly because we just don't understand the culture there. And a lot of the archaeologists I talked to said, you know, look, you don't need to have a big fancy house to be someone who is a chief or to have social hierarchy. And they may have had a lot of social hierarchy that we don't know about, that we just can't see because it was cultural and not part of their infrastructure. But at the same time, it's just fascinating to think about the fact that for so many hundreds of years, people lived in cities where the entire city grid was one story off the ground. And we don't build that way anymore for all kinds of reasons. One of which is just that if your neighbor moves away and their house collapses, now you've lost part of the street. So people really had to depend on their neighbors just to maintain their homes and to maintain the city infrastructure. And, you know, as that infrastructure started to fall apart, when people began to move away from the city, that was sort of the downfall of Çatalhöyük as a going concern. It just was too much labor to keep it up.
Before we get to the downfall, what are the thoughts on why people formed a city in the first place? Like what did people get out of living in such close quarters?
So there are a lot of questions about why people would ever have wanted to form a city, because when people did start building these early cities, humans had been basically nomads for over 100,000 years. And of course, our ancestors, Homo erectus, who invented fire and invented stone tools and a bunch of other cool stuff that we still use today, they also were nomadic. So if you want to include them in our history as a species, humans had been roving in nomadic bands for over a million years. And then suddenly, about 12,000 years ago, people start building these permanent settlements supported by agriculture. And it was a huge cultural shock. And again, questions remain. Archaeologists are still asking, why would we do that? And a couple of the answers are very practical. You know, one possibility is just safety. You know, people felt like greater numbers of neighbors would help protect them from the elements, help protect them perhaps from war. We don't know what the politics were 12,000 years ago. And we also know that certainly this would have been a way for people to have access to much more specialized tools, much finer material goods. You know, the more people you get together, the more that, artisans can practice their craft while, say, their neighbors go gather food. So you'd have nicer bowls, nicer rugs, nicer decorations in your house, nicer houses. People could spend time learning to build bricks better, which was indeed a technology of the day that was quite cutting edge. And the other piece of this is not at all pragmatic. People went to cities to have fun. And we see this over and over. Every city I looked at, and many cities I don't talk about in the book, one of the main attractors that anthropologists identify is ceremonies. People would come to these cities to visit because there were so many people there that they could put on an amazing party, you know, a giant feast with all kinds of bonfires and decorations and amazing painted, amazing cosmetics and dress up and, just everything that you associate with a party now, but projected back, say, 9,000 years. But people have been really influenced by the lure of parties and get-togethers and meeting other people for a really long time. And certainly if you moved to a city, like say you came to a city for a party and you would see, wow, there's all these other cool people here. Maybe I'll move here too. And that's what we see in the archaeological record, is that a lot of these early cities were seasonally quite populated. So people were coming there for kind of a feast or celebration season and then leaving again. But people would stay too, and so that's kind of how these places grew. And one of the things I love is that because of the fact that we see this a lot in the archaeological record, scientists have come up with ways of recognizing parties. How do you recognize a 9,000-year-old party? The best way to do it is to check to see if food that people were eating was tossed away before it was finished. So like a half-eaten bone from a deer piled in a big pit with a bunch of other half-eaten bones and maybe some broken plates. That's a sure sign that people have been feasting, because in normal times, you do not throw away a half-eaten bone. But if you're partying, apparently you do.
I have to say, I love the cities are the product of party guests who just overstayed theory so much.
Because hey, it's how San Francisco grew.
Yeah. Well, I think that the shorthand I lived with for a long time was just, first you get agriculture. Agriculture produces surpluses. Surpluses support soldiers, or soldiers take surpluses. It's kind of the same thing. And then whichever social structure has the most soldiers is the one that kind of squeezes out the other ones, like the pastoralists. But this, suggests like a much more endearing aspect of human behavior is in the driver's seat.
Yeah. And also that narrative that you're describing of like first comes agriculture, then comes surplus, that's really been called into question by archaeology really over the past, several decades now. We have quite a lot of evidence that, in fact, cities may have come before organized agriculture. And that agriculture itself has been developing in one way or another for about 45,000 years. And so what we think of today as a farm, of course, is very, very different from what people would have done 45,000 years ago. But people were doing things like controlled burns back then. They were scattering seeds of plants that they liked. And we can still see evidence of this by taking soil samples in jungles that people used to live in. And we can see layers of burn and layers of growth that is very different from the previous growth, and that clearly is, intended for people who are growing food or other products that they need. So it really seems like people were toying with cities and settlements for many thousands of years, and also toying with agriculture, and that they developed a little bit alongside each other and a little bit not. One of the earliest big settled year-round places. It's not really a city. It's a big place that people lived in year-round. It's called Göbekli Tepe, and it's also in central Turkey. Its culture probably led into the culture that later founded Çatalhöyük, the city that I talk about in my book. And Göbekli Tepe is absolutely a place where people lived. It has monumental architecture. It has incredible buildings and incredible signs of ceremonies and parties and rituals. But it isn't particularly associated with farms. And so it really does seem like the urge to gather together and party and also have cultural exchange kind of comes before this whole idea of surplus. And that narrative about agriculture and surplus, again, that comes from V. Gordon Childe, who helps to define cities. And he was very strongly influenced by Marxist thought, which helped him actually really understand history in a lot of ways. But also it meant that he focused a lot on the idea of economics in these cities, however economics were defined, you know, not necessarily through money, but through, say, surplus food. And I think that led to this misunderstanding that cities are the result of this kind of rational economic process of like gathering up, commodities and accumulating them and distributing them. Certainly that's true. Cities are doing that, but they're also doing all these other functions, these social functions and these community functions.
So Çatalhöyük, we've got this city that seems pretty successful in its own terms, kind of M.C. Escher type living setup. food is abundant enough that people can throw parties and discard half-eaten deer limbs for archaeologists to recover the remains of 9,000 years later. How does it come to an end?
So as I was hinting earlier, part of what happens is that it turns out that maintaining the infrastructure of Çatalhöyük is even more work than building it in the first place. You know, you can build a mud brick house in a day or two, but to maintain it, to keep it from falling over after, you know, a big storm or after you've been living in it for a while and the bricks naturally start crumbling, that takes a lot of time. And if you don't do it and you decide, you know what, this house, it's just falling apart, I'm going to leave and build a new one. Well, if you're in a city like Çatalhöyük, where all the houses are connected and all of the sidewalks lead across the roofs, if you let your house cave in, people are going to have a hard time getting to their houses because they're depending on you keeping your roof up so that they can get to their roof to get to their door. So things begin to really empty out at Çatalhöyük. And as people leave, more and more people have to leave because there are fewer and fewer people to maintain this infrastructure. The other thing that's funny about Çatalhöyük is because it is made with unfired brick, mud brick, every time a house collapses and people build a new house on top of it, they're kind of building on dirt and mud and clay that came from the bricks of that previous house. And over time, the city is on a hill, and the hill is built entirely out of these collapsed previous homes. And so not only is the city difficult to maintain, but the longer it goes on, the more you actually have to walk uphill to get home every day after you've gathered your food and gathered your water and gotten clay for doing various home improvement projects. So people are lugging stuff up a hill every day, then climbing ladders to get to their homes, then having to maintain their homes. So it was very labor intensive. And so archaeologists believe that eventually it just became too much. And, you know, the population required to maintain this place just wasn't there. And so very, very slowly, over a period of hundreds of years, the place finally empties out. And the very last signs of life that we see at Çatalhöyük are graves. Even once the city is abandoned and no one's living there, people still treasure it and they come back to the city to bury their dead. And so it becomes a kind of holy place. And then finally, it's covered over with enough dust and enough dirt that it's really only known to just local folks, local farmers in Turkey.
Is it fully accurate to say there wasn't enough labor to maintain it, or that the right structures didn't exist to organize that labor and divide the labor of maintaining it?
Yeah. So one of the ideas I talk about in my book is that the problem at Çatalhöyük was that there just wasn't a form of social organization that could help people keep the city in good shape, and that there needed to be some kind of top-down leadership or even collective leadership of labor dedicated to maintaining the infrastructure of the city. I think that's a really compelling idea. I think it's very possible that the problem at Çatal was social as much as it was about the physical infrastructure of the city. And when we see people returning to cities, basically after Çatalhöyük is abandoned, we don't see a lot of people building cities for a couple of thousand years in the region. There's a few other places that are kind of like Çatalhöyük, sort of big settlements that aren't very city-like. But then when cities do reemerge, it's the classic cities of Mesopotamia. It's Uruk with its giant ziggurat and massive streets and financial system and taxation and incredible social hierarchies with slaves and kings. And a lot of times anthropologists and historians will point to that and say, yeah, that's how you run a city. You have a top-down leadership, you have slave labor, and that's how it's done. And, you know, you have walls around the city and you have soldiers. It's not immediately clear to me that that's the only way to build a city either. But it's certainly a social structure that's radically different than what we think existed at Çatalhöyük, which would have been much more democratic and kind of collectively run, and also just kind of hodgepodge. You know, there wasn't a centralized authority, and you can absolutely see that in the architecture at Çatalhöyük, because people are just building stuff wherever they feel like it. And there's no, you know, set roadways, there's no urban plan.
So there's a very clear counterexample here of a city that is what might be described as a proper city, big, large structures, massive hierarchical organization that also succumbs to a form of collapse. This is Angkor, once the jewel of the Khmer Empire.
Yeah, that's right. So today it's located in Cambodia, and the Khmer Empire during the medieval period, our medieval period in the West, which is about 1,000 years ago, the Khmer Empire was quite vast. I mean, it stretched into Laos and Vietnam and Thailand before those were countries. And it was simply incredible in terms of its sophistication, its technological achievements. And Angkor, which was the capital city for hundreds of years, was a kind of city that is hard for us to imagine building now in the West, because it's a tropical city. It's at the center of two different monsoon systems, which any given year could just batter the city with rains and flooding, but then leave the city high and dry in these incredible droughts. And yet, this city supported almost 1 million people at its height, which makes it really pretty much one of the biggest cities in the world at that time, dwarfing a bunch of cities in Europe. And the question that archaeologists have had, and historians and urban planners, is how did they maintain such an incredible, huge city with amazing artistic output and productivity in this place that seems like it would be impossible to live, just in terms of the climate? And the answer was, again, infrastructure. This was a civilization that had incredible mastery over water engineering. The engineers, the workers in the city, ordered by the king, built kilometers and kilometers of canals and reservoirs to hold water from the monsoon season, from the rainy season into the dry season. And these reservoirs are extraordinary. I took a boat across one of them, and it's about 7 kilometers long. It's huge. You feel like you're on a lake. But this is a human-made structure. And Angkor is full of these enormous reservoirs called barai. And they were pulling water down from the mountains using canals. And what happened eventually was the same thing in a sense that happens to any city that's struggling, which is that the rich got richer, the poor got poorer. The city maintained its infrastructure using a system that's called debt slavery, or tax slavery is another term for it. Basically, workers would work for the city for free, for the, you know, for the Khmer rulers for free for part of the year in exchange for the, you know, different niceties that they got from living in the city. Basically, in order to live in the city, they would have to do free labor. And that actually worked for a while, partly because a lot of the local leaders and the leaders in Angkor were very generous in compensating these workers in non-monetary ways, like giving them rice, giving them food for their families, housing their families, doing all kinds of simple, low-cost things to make the workers' lives happy. And of course, Angkor, like any good city, had amazing parties. Like, there are so many accounts written by, you know, visitors from China, visitors from other parts of the world saying, wow, I got here. I'm not translating exactly, but they would say like, wow, I got here. And like, there were parades and everything was like, you know, full of incense and flowers and just like all kinds of cool stuff was going on, games. And you could just buy any great food right there on the street. And so it was just a fun place to live for a very long time. But again, as the city's infrastructure got hammered over and over by flooding and drought, the city just couldn't keep up. And there's no reason to think that Angkor couldn't still be around today if its leaders had decided to prioritize keeping their workforce happy. But that's not what they did. And workers began leaving. The infrastructure, after a particularly bad set of floods and droughts, really was crumbling. And in the 15th century, the royal family decides to just hightail it out. You know, they're like, everything sucks. It's just too flooded and too broken down. We're going to Phnom Penh. And indeed, Phnom Penh is now where the royal palace is today in Cambodia. So once the leaders were gone, you actually see this period of revitalization in Angkor, which I think is something that we should all really think about a lot, because there's a kind of popular narrative about Angkor that it, quote unquote, falls when its royal family leaves. But really, the city keeps going for about 100 years after that. And it's because workers are living there and recycling a lot of the crumbling buildings and using them for new infrastructure. They're farming in the city and not having too bad of a time of it, actually. And again, this is kind of a path not taken for Angkor. I think it's possible that under different circumstances, it could have become a more democratic city where people just farmed in the city and had slightly more humble lives than they had before. But that wasn't really the path. People continued to leave the city and kind of went back to villages and farms where they felt more comfortable and where they had communities that they enjoyed. And so the city, much like Chitalhuayuk, became kind of a pilgrimage location. It became a holy place. And when Europeans found it, quote unquote, found it, when Europeans wandered by in the 19th century, it was still full of farmers and monks who were taking care of the temples there. So it had a very, very, very slow period of emptying out that really lasted for almost as long as the city's high points. You know, it was absolutely packed with people, and then it took a long time for that million people to leave.
So, like, if we kind of counterpose this to Chitalhuayuk, right? Here's one city that maybe didn't have enough of a hierarchy to organize the labor it would take to maintain its infrastructure. Here's another city that succumbed to the internal dynamics of its own hierarchy. It leaves you feeling like, you know, whatever you're starting with, cities are doomed, but most cities, in fact, have not succumbed and dissolved over human history.
Well, Actually, I'm not sure if it's true about most cities. In fact, a lot of cities do kind of have a kind of gentle phase of abandonment. But lots and lots of cities have also stayed vital and stayed at the center of their communities for thousands of years. You know, cities like Damascus, I mean, that city has thousands and thousands of years of history, and it's still going. I mean, it's hurting, but it's going. And then places like Istanbul or London, these are cities, again, that have lasted for a super long time. Of course, Mexico City is built on top of an indigenous city that was a going concern for a very long time. And so cities change. They transform. The reason why I mentioned Mexico City is you could easily read it as a kind of continuation of the city that was there before, the Aztec city. And the same thing with Istanbul. That's a city that outlasted multiple empires and has had multiple names, but it's still kind of the same place, kind of a different place. And what we see in these examples of urban survival is that cities often look like they're in the process of dying or being abandoned and then come back through revitalization. And that's what's so interesting about Angkor, is that we see the beginning of that revitalization process and then it kind of peters out. But it could very easily have continued in that vein. It could have become a very different and a new city. And so when we think about our modern cities, we have to understand that cities don't stay the same. And a healthy city is a city that's changing. And on top of that, a healthy city is one that changes to meet the needs of its workers as well as the needs of its elites. So you can't have a city that's transforming exclusively through gentrification, because that's a kind of transformation that tends to leave out the needs of workers. Little bit of gentrification, just fine. But you also need to have affordable housing, or the, you know, year 1000 equivalent of affordable housing, which did exist. And so that's the thing that we have to keep our eye on, is that cities are always evolving and transforming.
I mean, I'm curious, the way you just described that perfectly fits the narrative frame of someone living in present day San Francisco.
yes.
the field of archaeology is now kind of littered with generations of people who constructed narratives about how ancient societies much have worked that with hindsight we now see were very much products of their own political predispositions and don't hold up to the evidence that well. Do you think about which narratives we have today that might be products of our own sensibility that we'll be abandoning in the future?
Yeah, you know, one of the myths that I have been encountering a lot over the last 10 years is the myth of the smart city. And this is a story that I hear a lot because, of course, I'm in the Bay Area and I know lots of people who work in Silicon Valley. And the theory is that a city will get better the more that we can use connected devices to gather data about what people are doing in the city. And sometimes that makes sense if you're talking about gathering data on, say, how the electrical grid is used, and so figuring out how to make a smart grid. Some of it just sounds like a crazy dream from surveillance capitalism, where it's a way of exacerbating the conflicts between the haves and have-nots, placing certain neighborhoods under surveillance, allowing other neighborhoods to thrive without that level of police intervention. And I think this I really do think that we're going to be looking back, even as soon as 100 years, at crumbling smart cities that have been abandoned because someone built them up and then there was no way to maintain the infrastructure because they were just either built so poorly or because it turned out people didn't actually want to have a refrigerator that talked to some city operator on the city's operating system grid. And people maybe didn't want to have cameras everywhere monitoring when they come and go in their house to figure out, you know, when they wanted their lights turned on or when they would need a new box of cereal. So that, I think, is a myth that's going to go away. The myth that a smarter city is a better city. I actually think a dumber city is a better city. I think we need to remember that what holds cities up is actually really basic stuff like a good sewer system and public parks and public buildings that are in good repair and public restrooms. Even in ancient Rome, they had pretty decent public restrooms. I mean, you know, they were stinky, but they were there and they were free for all. And I think those are the kinds of things that we lose sight of when we focus on whether we can make a building really, really smart.
And also, I mean, like if you contrast city life to, say, you know, life in the kinship structures of a hunter-gatherer society, like the serendipity of meeting someone you don't already know everything about. Like, that's like the quintessential urban experience, is being an anonymous part of a crowd, being able to reinvent yourself in relationship with new people.
That's absolutely true. And I think that's one of the parts of cities that has continued to be their most beautiful and alluring feature is, you know, come here and see things you've never seen before, created by people you never met before, find new friends, find new family. One of the things I found super intriguing about Çatalhöyük is that now that we've been able to sequence DNA from some of the human remains there, we find that a lot of the kinship groups, like, and kinship groups are just people who were buried together, they're not always related. In fact, often they're not related. And so we know that people were coming together in what we would call today chosen families or found families. And that's what cities can give you. You know, small town life, village life tends to group people in biological families. And cities let you invent something completely new.
I'd love to spend a couple minutes on Cahokia before we wrap up the interview, because of all the things in the book, this is the one that most embarrassed me about how little I knew, like, about pre-European contact Native American history. This is a massive urban development straddling both sides of the Mississippi River.
That's right. Yeah, Cahokia would have had, at its height, possibly as many as 30,000 people there, maybe 20,000 people. And of course, seasonally, because it was a party town, there would have been a lot more people. Cahokia was at the center of a culture which we call the Mississippian, which is a collection of cities and villages along the Mississippi and the Missouri rivers and other tributaries from the Mississippi. And they're kind of all at their height about 1,000 years ago. And we know that they're connected because they shared an architectural love of mounds, really high and beautifully shaped, packed earth structures. And these are really shown off at their most spectacular in Cahokia. And at the heart of Cahokia was a mound that is now called Monk's Mound, which is a giant pyramid with different levels on it. So it kind of had a flat top, and its footprint is roughly equivalent to the Great Pyramid at Giza. So it was giant. And it's surrounded by this massive plaza where thousands of people could have gathered. And the city itself, which does in fact stretch across the Mississippi into St. Louis, is characterized by many different mounds of all different sizes used in all kinds of ways. Some of them were ritualistic. Some of them were clearly burial mounds or ceremonial. Some of them may have just been used for like street signs. And there were big roads. There were all kinds of water features in this city. And it was built really quickly, like a lot of American cities are now. And it was simply incredible. And people abandoned it long before Europeans arrived and kind of found the remains of the mounds. And the people who lived there really kind of morph into or evolve into a lot of the Sioux tribes and nations. A lot of other groups, kind of came from that culture. It's kind of like the North American version of Rome. It was an incredible a city that did not leave any writing that we can recognize behind, didn't have money, didn't have a marketplace. And instead, what they had was a really well-developed sports culture. We know that they played a game called chunky that's played with these stone pucks and spears. And the chunky stones are very recognizable. They look a little bit like very, very beautiful hockey pucks. And we see them all up and down the Mississippi. And we know that there was a certain kind that was made at Cahokia. And people came from all over to party at Cahokia. And often they would take home chunky stones from Cahokia, like as a souvenir. So these were people who were connected by ritual. They were connected by fun and sports and a love of barbecue. So they shared a lot with the people who came later and settled the land. And it was just an incredible place.
But what leads to its abandonment? It's not sacked by Visigoths. It's already been abandoned by the time smallpox gets introduced to the continent. So why is it a ruin?
Yeah, it's not destroyed by white settler colonialism like so many other great indigenous cities were. It has its own natural kind of filling up and population and abandonment. And one of the things that is so fascinating is we know for certain that there wasn't any particular environmental catastrophe. There's no record of the city kind of falling apart or, mistreating certain people and kind of driving them away. But we do see very strong evidence that the city underwent a couple of pretty dramatic transformations. So new social movements must have come through. The city was on a very strict north-south grid that was clearly centrally planned for at least 100 years. And then we see a shift where suddenly people start building neighborhoods that are much more loosely planned. The houses tend to be built around circular courtyards. The neighborhoods become a little bit further apart. And that big mound at the center of town with that big plaza where we're certain that people gathered and had rituals, people stop using that at a certain point. And indeed, they start tossing trash around that mound and into that plaza. So they're really not using it. And in fact, maybe they're rejecting it. And Melissa Baltus, who is one of the archaeologists I spent time with down there, said that she thought that possibly what happened was people grew disenchanted with whatever that big mound meant and kind of turned away from it and built neighborhoods that weren't based around ideas from that mound, and that slowly over time, those neighborhoods got further and further apart. And finally, people just wondered, well, why are we staying here? We don't need to be in this place. We're already in our own little kind of village-like grouping. Why don't we just hightail it out of here and go up the river, go up north, go down south, just follow the river to a new place? So it was very organic. And the other piece of this that's really important is that part of the ritual culture that we see at Cahokia involves a ritual that archaeologists call closing up. And it's something that we see in every house where when people leave the house, people grow old and die, so they're no longer using the house or they move somewhere else. They take the house apart and they burn the floor of the house along with some offerings. Often those offerings are buried in the floor. They might be treasured objects from the people who lived there. It might be just kind of like sparkly stone, like mica, or projectile points, all kinds of stuff. And then once they've burned the floor and burned these offerings, they put a new layer of clay down and then build the next house on top. So they've kind of closed up the house. The house itself, all the houses were made from wood and thatch. The house has a kind of built-in expiration date, as it were. There's no sense that that house should last forever. which is very different from a kind of Western European idea where people talk about building a house to last. You know, this house should stand forever. And if the house kind of crumbles away, we feel just intense sadness because we don't want that for our houses. But at Cahokia, people did. People had a whole ritual for saying goodbye to a house and for getting rid of that structure and recycling the parts of it that could be used again or turning it into firewood. And so one possibility is that the whole city, Cahokia itself, was never meant to last. Maybe it was just a city that people said, hey, this is a cool place to live for a while. The farmland is good. The parties are good. We like hanging out here. But, you know, we could take it or leave it. And if we leave, that's okay. And I think, again, that's something that's really good for us to hold in mind as city dwellers, that our cities have to change. And that also, if we leave a city behind, that that isn't a failure. That can just be part of what it means to be in a city, is that it doesn't always last.
That's a sweet place to end it. Annalena, it was such a pleasure to go through the book. And thank you so much for making so much time to speak to us about it.
Thank you so much for having me.
Annalie Newitz is a longtime science journalist and editor. They do a podcast on the politics of speculative fiction called Our Opinions Are Correct. And their brand new book is Four Lost Cities, A Secret History of the Urban Age.